Hello and welcome back to The More From Grace. I'm joined today by Ricky.
Hello, it's good to be back.
We've had another week of scintillating Six Nations action and we're going to dive into it for you today. First up, we had Ireland versus Wales. It's final score of 31-7. Ireland just seemed unstoppable in that first half. They just seem unstoppable this year. What are your thoughts, Ricky?
Well, if you look at the Six Nations so far, it has just been absolutely ridiculous. The scoring margins are just... how do you stop this team? You look at the first game, it was 21 points versus France. You look at Italy, they nilled them 36-0. And then now, 24 points over Wales. It's just... I can't see anyone stopping them. But if there is one team that will stop them, I do believe it's Scotland, unfortunately.
Yeah. I don't know. I'd put an outside bet on England. Hopeful, but we'll get into that next week. Ireland are just unstoppable. And that is the big point. It's almost... We're saying every week, Wales are in a point of transition and Ireland are probably at the peak of their powers. Or at least they've continued from the World Cup. Almost this game, despite the scoreline... It's almost the boring match. I mean, it is the boring match of the weekend. There's not really that many talking points because all the talking points are just things we've already hashed over that everyone knows.
Precisely. It's like you kind of expected this game to be like a, you know, an Italy game where you've got Ireland drubbing Italy or something like that. But this time it's Wales. And I don't know, there's some positives for Wales. You can say that the back line, again, was quite solid. But it's just such a... dominant side, you can't really argue much.
Yeah, of course, they got that penalty try just after half time, and it almost felt at 17-7 that the game was within grasp, but Ireland just found another gear. Again, they're 3 from 3, they've got 3 bonus points there, 15 points, sitting happy at the top of the tree. If they can get a bonus point against England this weekend, I think they're untouchable. I think this match could actually next weekend be the match that seals their fate. So yeah, if Ireland do get a bonus point next weekend, they've won the Six Nations with a week to spare, which would be, it'd be quite ridiculous, really. Wales' penalty try, that's probably the highlight. The fact they got that rolling maul, they got that collapse. Tadhg Birme went to the bin. James Ryan obviously went to the bin later on in the match as well. But it didn't stop Ireland. Ireland just sort of found inspiration from it. it's ridiculous to say. We've almost got to be grateful to be able to watch a team at this point like that. We.
That crazy argument that can Ireland get past the quarterfinals? It's one of those, but genuinely I feel like this is a true dynasty of a team that we will be seeing probably win the Six Nations for a few years to come, unless Scotland can 1 year challenge them. I can't see England doing it next year or this year at all.
Yeah, well, we all know that like rugby is moving to a 4-year cycle period. Coaches are, they're really rewarded and they're really judged based on their World Cup performance. A Six Nations is good, but if you won no Six Nations but got to a World Cup final, then you're going to be deemed a success. I think Ireland have almost tipped that on its head. They've never got past the quarterfinal, we all know this. But if they can win back-to-back Six Nations, back-to-back Grand Slams... And if they can really create a legacy within the Six Nations, you can't say that they're not one of the best sides that there ever was, really. Particularly if they're getting results against Southern Hemisphere teams like they have against New Zealand in New Zealand. It's a strange one because it almost goes against the way that we as the rugby media, we as the rugby fans, almost view success relatively recently. Before, as I said, before you would win a Six Nations and you would go, this is a great result, but that's sort of changed in the last 8 years.
Call me strange, I've always been one that's a stickler for the Six Nations being like the calendar of the rugby year for me. I do love the Autumn Tests and I love the World Cup, but there's just something different about the Six Nations that makes you think you want to beat these teams over and over again. And if Ireland can do that, they can say they are like one of the best teams ever, in my opinion.
It comes down to the rivalries. It's so historic. Ireland versus Wales is a historic rivalry. Everyone against England is a historic rivalry. These are matches steeped in history, and we're seeing that. And this Ireland team is is a team with a legacy and a team that seems to just be unstoppable, as we've already said.
Just one thing, we must give our good friend Sam France credit, because he did pick Dan Sheehan as his fantasy player of the week.
He did indeed, but is that really that much of an outside bet?
Absolutely not.
He gets a try off the back of that rolling ball every single week. James Lowe gets a try every week. Almost, James Lowe's try was so unnoteworthy, the fact that you just come to expect it. The same with Dan Sheehan. A hooker scoring tries every week should be something that, you know, when we saw Dane Coles do it for New Zealand, it was sort of seen as, oh my god, this is the best hooker in the world. With Dan Sheehan, he's part of this machine. He is one of the best hookers in the world. But this machine of Ireland almost makes each player better than they are. Not to say that they're all bad players or that they're all underrated, but it brings them all up together, I always feel.
How good were they on defence though, Henry?
Well, they only conceded a penalty try. What else is there to say?
Ridiculous. We saw that in the very last minutes being held up again. I think that happened twice in the game as well. Just, how do you stop this team?
It's getting ridiculous at this point. Obviously, there's been the jokes, there's been the comments saying, oh, it's time for Ireland to leave the Six Nations to join the Rugby Championship where they could be really, really challenged. Then obviously, it's a joke. It's so stupid they've almost got a point. But I think when it comes to the autumn test, when they're playing those teams, it will be when all the other teams are playing those teams, it will be a real marker of just how good Ireland are. Is it Ireland are just such a good side, or is it the other sides are in those transition points, are struggling themselves, making Ireland look better? I'd lean towards the former, saying that Ireland are just insane right now, but we'll find out.
Absolutely. I don't know if you saw Rio Dyer's comments this week, stating that he does not want to be the plucky loser's side. What do you think about this Wales team so far?
It's a team in transition. We've said it before. I don't think Warren Gatland's too worried about results this year. Again, it's the opposite philosophy. It's that four-year plan. I think Wales are a team with the outgoings they've had, and also just with the scandals that they've had within the WRU, they're a team that probably can afford and should afford to just build now. Success right now will probably be forgotten. It'll be a bit like, what was it, during the COVID years where Wales had a pretty weak side, but they still won the Six Nations somehow, and nobody saw that coming. But if that happened now, we don't look back at that team and go, that was a great team, because they weren't. They, not to say they got lucky, but I'm sure when Wales back, he'll definitely have a differing opinion. But I think it's just a team that can afford to build, and probably rightfully so. Give it a couple of years, and these players will be something different. We're seeing it with the emergence of Aaron Wainwright. He's always been on the scene, but he is frankly world class right now. You wouldn't even notice that Faletau's not there. He's been that good. They need to work on their fly halves. We've said this already. And again, that comes down to injuries, that comes down to development. They're playing young players, and that will reap rewards.
What about Sam Costello's performance? I thought he had a pretty solid game in total, but obviously they weren't able to do anything of any real result.
Well, he had a bit of a stinker against Scotland. He knows that. Everyone knows that. Ian Lloyd's been good. He's been good, if not spectacular, or if unspectacular. Costello, I think, is the player that they're really, really touting as their future in that 10 jersey. I think he's a good bet for it. And he's just going to get better with time and with experience. I think, again, exactly, they're investing in these young players with the hope that it will come off. And now on to Scotland versus England. I'd rather not talk about this match personally, but I suppose we have to. Yeah, it was one of those. It was a doozy.
For all you listening out there, you would love to see Henry's face right now.
I'm glad we don't record this. I'm glad you didn't see us in the pub on Saturday. That was... It was rocky.
just depressing, wasn't it, really?
Yeah.
After such a positive start.
Again, England are in a similar position to Wales in that they can afford to... They can afford to build. I think, you know, they got to the World Cup semi-finals. They came third at the World Cup. But it is a transition period. Probably the first two matches against Wales and against Italy maybe gave an unrealistic expectation. England still theoretically could win. A win against Ireland would be unexpected. I think a win against France is now doable. But again, Ireland's unstoppable, so I don't think it will. But yeah, you would think from the way the rugby media talks that as soon as England lose one match, everything's gone. It's Steve Borthwick. I can't stand that narrative, as you know, Ricky. But yeah, England looked good in the first 20 minutes, I thought.
Oh, that Furbank try, you just thought everything was going to click for once, didn't you? Like,
yeah.
Everything just seemed to flow, the ball was moving quickly, there were some nice little dummy passes here and there. Obviously set in Furbank lovely. And then, can we put it down to Duhan van der Merwe, or...?
I think he was the game changer. I don't know if he's the sole contributor, but he changed the game. But I think with Furbank at 15, I said it in our group chat before the match, when he was first selected, he was either going to have a world-class performance, like how he's been playing for Northampton, or he was going to play like he did against France a couple of years ago, where it didn't go well for him. And somehow he did both. That first 20 minutes, I stuck a message in the chat saying, Furbank world-class performance incoming. 20 minutes later, Furbank stinker incoming. It was mixed. I think there was a noticeable turning point, and unfortunately it was when the ball hit Furbank's face. I think before that, Duhan van der Merwe's first try, the game was still within reach. That was one freak moment. But the game was gone after that, I'm afraid. After that second try. What were your thoughts?
Handling errors, just not acceptable on a Six Nations stage, let alone any international stage. I think perhaps just where did that cohesion go? It's like they got hit really hard in the mouth after that Duhan van der Merwe try, and then they just forgot how to play simple rugby.
It was sloppy. I think that's probably the best word to use. Just the execution wasn't there. I think maybe once everything clicks, everything, give it a year, everything will click, hopefully, fingers crossed. But right now, it's not looking great. But that's not to say England are in a bad spot, just that, yeah, the cake's not cooked, let's say it that way.
I know hindsight is a wonderful thing, but Furbank or Freddie Stewart, would you, having watched this game now, would you have started Stewart?
So it's interesting because I've seen Squid Rugby actually mentioned it in their preview. The selection of Furbank at 15 signalled that England probably wanted to play slightly differently. They know, despite the fact that Scotland are the team that have kicked the most, the two players that have kicked the most in this championship before this weekend were Ben White and Finn Russell, Scotland's 9 and 10. And that really signals how they're kicking, but they weren't kicking necessarily contestable kicks that someone like Freddie Stewart would be really powerful for, but rather someone like George Furbank with that kicking ability could be fine with, and they almost wanted to play more of a territory-based game. Yeah, I think had things gone right, George Furbank could have been a shrewd selection, but Freddie Stewart is one of, if not the best, 15 in the world. You can't not pick him, unfortunately. I think he'll definitely be playing in the next match. I have no doubt. But
Fur back to the bench.
I think,
sorry, I had to drop that.
Yeah. Watching the England A match at the weekend against Portugal, unofficially A, Josh Hodge had a blinder. It's difficult to read into too much because it's essentially a very good Premiership side against almost like a Nat 1 level team. But Josh Hodge was so good. I think George Furbank now has... I don't like to be too critical on players, but I think he's had his chance at England. He can't, he's not that level. I think he's a very good Northampton player, but I don't think it's too harsh at this point to say he's not cutting it at England in the same, in a similar way to Max Maylands, how he's almost been dropped out of contention in favour of Furbank, actually. I think it's time to look at another option. I think it was a good choice to play Furbank in this match. England need to develop depth. Obviously, we've got Marcus Smith that can cover 15 in emergency. We saw that at the World Cup. But realistically, we need depth in that position. But, yeah, in a match like that, Freddie Stewart probably... He wouldn't have been the difference, but he could have helped things somewhat.
Are we unfairly placing the blame on him, or can we should also talk about perhaps... I know Ollie Lawrence didn't have the finest of games himself, did he?
No, entirely. Like I said, I don't like being too critical on players. It's just because it was such a talking point, you can't not talk about... talk about Furbank selection. But exactly, Ollie Lawrence didn't have his best game. I think maybe that's because he's been out injured, he's coming back into the fold, but equally, would Fraser Dingwall have done any better? I'm not convinced. I don't think
neither
I don't think Fraser Dingwall is England quality. I think he's a good player,
another Saint.
But then Saints are top of the table in the Premiership,
yeah,
you can't overlook that. But yeah, Danny Kerr, I'm a big fan of Danny Kerr. He didn't have a great game either. I hope he starts again against Ireland for his 100th cap. I'll be really upset if, you know, he got dropped entirely. That, I think that would just be brutal. But he didn't have a good game either. I think just Scotland put too much pressure on England, and England couldn't cope. And that's saying that almost the tables have turned, where a few years ago Scotland weren't winning these matches because they couldn't handle the pressure, and now it's the other way around. And I think England's inexperience is sort of showing with their less experienced players and players that have been out of the fold a little bit.
I agree. I'm just, I don't know, it's a very fine line as to what we can do here. We're at a bit of a loss when it comes to injuries and stuff like that, so Danny Kerr is obviously a wonderful player. Maybe getting
very good.
Yeah. But he is getting on a bit. But at the same time, who are you going to put in his place at this current point?
Well, exactly.
A big game against Ireland. We need that experience as well on the field, I think, against one of the best like machines in rugby.
Yeah, no, exactly. I think Danny Kerr's still got at least till the end of the Six Nations in him. Rumour is he could be off to France next year. I hope not, but if he is, he is. I think Harry Randall, again, with the England A match was very good, but as a scrum half, when you've got that much time and that much space, it's easier to look good. He still played well, you still have to play well to look good. But, you know, it's not the most fair reflection on international rugby comparing Danny Kerr against Scotland to Harry Randall against a second string Portugal side. It's a tough one. Whether you start Ben Spencer next week, I feel like he did add a different dimension to the match. But yeah, Danny Kerr has to be in the squad for me.
What about the experience? Isn't
yeah,
it?
It's a match that for England it's a must win, and I don't think it's a match that you can necessarily gamble on. But We've spoken enough about England here. I think
precisely.
We've got to give credit to Scotland. They were absolutely outrageous. It's probably up there with the best, with the most comprehensive Scottish performance I've ever seen. Doohan Van der Merwe, he's just outrageous. I've got my own personal issues with him. We'll get onto that later when we got onto the fantasy segment. But they were just so good. Doohan Van der Merwe was an absolute game changer. Finn Russell, he's just a different grade. He is the best fly half in the world right now.
Yeah, and there's no question that he should be starting for the Lions.
100%. And I teased this before we started recording, Ricky, but I've got a little stat here.
Oof.
This is the first time that Scotland have beaten England four times in a row since 1893 to 1896.
1893?
Yeah. That's insane.
Is this...
That's over 100.
That is mental.
That's 100 and almost 120 years that they haven't done that.
That's effectively almost an entire history of rugby.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? Credit to Scotland. I thought they were magnificent all over the field. They just... I don't know where... Because they've had them injuries themselves. They're not like a complete full team. But they just look like a different level to England for the like 20 minutes onwards to the end.
Exactly.
They're like more composed.
Jamie Ritchie came back. I thought he was outstanding. Jamie Ritchie is a player that I'm a big fan of. I think he really plays, the way he plays flanker is a way that I really admire. He's been stripped of the captaincy. He's probably a bit too extreme, but he's no longer captain. Part of that is probably to do with he wasn't the best at communicating with refs, but I still think his presence within the team is still felt quite strongly, and you could see that on the pitch. But yeah, Scotland will always target England, and he's really reaping rewards right now.
Yeah, I mean, it's 4 wins in a row. It's 5 out of 6 in the Calcutta Cup. For England, it's a bit embarrassing, but you know, we are in that phase of rebuilding. Or where is next?
Yeah, Scotland have become, saying it's a bogey team is maybe not getting the credit that Scotland deserve, but Scotland's become a real issue for England. It's just becoming disappointing as an England fan.
The ferocity of Murrayfield, I have to say, as soon as Scotland started to get in the game, do you think England felt a bit under the cosh from the raucous crowd?
Maybe. For me, Murrayfield, England versus Scotland, Calcutta Cup, that's a bucket list match. I think that's possibly in the Six Nations, like, my number one pick for a bucket list match, with how the results have been going at the moment. If I could be there for England to break this duck at Murrayfield in 2 years' time, the things that... It'd be such a good match to be at, England could pull that off. But at the same time, it's the worst place in the world to be when England lose.
Precisely. Right, shall we move on to probably the biggest game of the weekend in terms of talking points?
Absolutely. France versus Italy. We've got to give a little shout out again to Sam France for last week. His recommendation that maybe Italy could spring an upset, maybe they could spring a surprise. They didn't quite go as far as he suggested they could, but blimey, they were close.
Yeah, I think, well, let's go through the red card. Definite red card.
Yeah, no two ways about it. That's the type of tackle that the World Rugby want to eradicate, and it was the right choice. I like the use of the bunker. Not sure why it's not being used in the Premiership this year. That's confused me a little bit.
It's a brilliant introduction, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's fantastic. It's a little bit confusing when it's not explained well on commentary, but I think most fans understand it now. And yeah, they got the right answer, they got the right result. Yeah, no quarrels whatsoever, but that changed the game.
I figure it must be very hard as a fan in the ground when the bunker is initiated, though.
Definitely, but I believe this Six Nations there, they're saying in the crowd, they're broadcasting what the decision is and what the reasoning is, which, yeah, I think that's fantastic. But that changed the game for France. France looked a little bit weak, but they looked in control in the first half. And then, yeah, it changed when Donty went off. And particularly when Mathieu Jalibert, unfortunately, got injured. And they had to reshuffle their back line. Thomas Ramos went to fly half. And yeah, it was too much for them.
Well, he's now out for the rest of the Six Nations, which is...
It's unfortunate, but injuries happen.
Thomas Ramos is more than capable of stepping into that role as well. He's done it with Toulouse many times.
He's played a nut like most of his recent, I think it's sort of like 8 of his last 10 matches or something like that, he's played fly half for Bordeaux, that is. So I don't think it'll be too much of an issue for them. Obviously, it's not ideal for them, you know, their first two fly half choices being out injured, but what can you do in that situation?
Maybe it'll spark something else in France. Yeah. You never know.
You've just got to get on with it. France are a team that historically has always thrived with adversity, so we'll see. But I think, yeah, Italy, after that point, particularly after the Jalibert injury, they just turned it on. It almost felt inevitable that they were going to draw a level. And actually, we have to get onto that final kick.
Blimey, there's just too much to break down on this, to be honest.
I was sat there, just hands on my head, mouth wide open, just praying that it went through. I've got a soft spot for Italy. They are my adopted second team within the Six Nations, possibly even within World Rugby, besides maybe the USA. That's another team, but that's a story for another day. Yeah, I prayed Garbisi was going to get it. And it's been controversial. Would you care to explain?
Excuse me. Let's start with issue one. The ball fell off the tee. Now, all this conspiracy theories about it's a closed ground.
You just didn't put it on the tee properly.
Precisely. There was no wind there.
There was no wind, but that's just unfortunate. It'll be...
Do you think the shot clock should be restarted if the ball falls off the tee?
No, I don't. Because it's on the fly half to put the ball on the tee properly. You can't make exceptions just because a mistake's been made. Yeah, I think it's unfortunate. It's unfortunate, but it is what it is. The issue, however...
Big issue.
...is the behaviour of the French players. Not to say that I would have behaved any differently. I probably would have done exactly the same, but that's not the point.
It's getting away with it.
Yeah. The argument is that they charged it down, or at least attempted to charge it down when the ball went off the tee, and Paolo Garbisi went to replace the ball. Obviously, we saw against Wales for England, George Ford had a similar issue where he stepped to the side and the Welsh players were able to actually come and charge the ball down.
None of this matters here, though.
But none of this matters. It was a penalty. I think, yeah, there was a little bit of confusion. The French players... credit to, this is probably going too far, but to give them the benefit of the doubt, they did back out. It wasn't like they actually charged it down properly, they just sort of approached a little bit. But
let's think about natural instinct here for a second.
You see
two big men running at you and you're trying to place the ball back after panicking because the shot clock is coming
with 8 seconds left.
Yes, his run up was far shorter because he was panicking.
I it is a really tricky one because, as well, there was a French water boy on the pitch as well that perhaps shouldn't have been there. Again, putting undue pressure on Paolo Garbisi. It's a really difficult one for Christophe Ridley. I thought, besides this moment, I thought he had an absolutely fantastic game. It is his first ever Six Nations match that he's refereed. I thought he had a really good game. I thought he was really solid. But in this situation, what do you do? Because he can either, if he went letter of the law...
penalise them 10.
You penalise France 10 metres, you push them back, make the kick 10 metres closer, and then, you know, you reset the shot clock. But that's just not going to happen. He's given a red card. And imagine the abuse he would have received. There's been a lot of focus on referee abuse. The abuse he'd have received as match fixing or whatever for allowing that, it would have been horrific.
But it's not. I understand that it would be horrific, but when you are a referee on the biggest stage, you've got to do it by the letter of the law. We saw Scotland against France. I mean, France have had a couple of dodgy things in the last minutes of the game that's happened to them, haven't they?
Exactly. They are a TMO being asked a slightly different question and the ball not falling off a tee away from being 0-3, which, considering where we were seeing before the World Cup and even during the World Cup, that's crazy to think, just the fall off. But I think with the re-kick decision, it's a really difficult one. I think in an ideal world, you would probably, the fairest decision is maybe reset the shot clock, because not because the ball fell off, but because of the supposed charge down, or at least reset the clock to where it was when it was charged down, and then have the kick taken from where it is. I imagine there will be conversations within World Rugby, because there always is when there's a controversial decision. Will we see a law change? Who knows? What did you think?
I just think it's very clear that it's encroachment towards, as I said, like, you've got two massive blokes, the ball off the tee. You kind of just, it completely affects the way you kick the ball, you can tell. And he's not a bad kicker, he's a very good kicker.
I mean, he still hit the post.
Yeah.
Imagine that went through, the absolute scenes if that had gone through.
He did ref a great game. I just unfortunately think that you have to go by the law. And I know abuse is it, what do you do?
Yeah, it's why I say there's no right answer. In the same way that with the Scotland-France match a couple of weeks back, there was almost no wrong answer in a weird way. There's no right answer here. But, yeah, it's a really difficult one. We've seen that there was an interaction, actually, over the weekend where Paul Williams put the question about what you can do, and Nigel Owens actually responded, saying that, you know, it was encroachment. But even he was a little bit wishy-washy with his answer, not necessarily going as far to say, you know, you reset the shot clock and everything, but he just sort of explained the law. So, on to the fantasy section. I'm an idiot. Let's start there.
Plain and simple.
I thought with my heart and selected with my heart, not with my head. I did not select Doohan van der Merwe. Yeah. I took him out of my team because I thought there's no way James Lowe wasn't going to score. I thought against Italy, there's no way Thomas Ramos wasn't going to rack up a load of points. I thought there's no way that Damien Penno was going to have a bad game, that he wouldn't score.
I understand that, to be fair. Like, you know, it's not been like your clinical fantasy points Six Nations, has it?
No, I've almost got to this point where I've gone, it is over for me, I'm just going to play with my heart now.
Let's just have a look at the Sports Gazette League for you.
Yeah, I was hopeful that, hopeful more than expecting, that, you know, Scotland weren't going to have a good game, that Doohan van der Merwe wasn't going to rack up a brace, let alone a hat-trick.
Yeah, so at top of the league, we have our good friend and our host from More From Grace. That is Will on 1,060 points, closely followed by me on 1,041 points. Now, what's after that, Henry?
Yeah, after that, I believe we won't talk about it. After that, we have Sam, who was on last week, and then we have Michael. Michael has no interest in rugby, really.
So it's quite impressive that he is.
He's done really well. I think he's done almost what I've neglected to do, where he's gone for, I've heard of this name, I'm going to select him. Whereas I've tried to be almost a bit too clever with it.
Too intricate.
And go, because there's been multiple matches where I've still had like players worth of stars left in my team, that it left in my budget, because I'm trying to be too smart. I'm trying to think almost Moneyball, but too much. I did make one great choice actually this weekend, which was starting Jack Crowley over Finn Russell. He actually scored more points, which I was very surprised to see. Crowley scored 31 to Finn Russell's 23, which seemed weirdly low for Finn Russell. But yeah, I'm about 150 points behind you boys.
You know what? I've had a bit of a loss as to where to go with scrum half, because scrum half is just not producing anything, is it?
No, I think someone like Jamison Gibson-Park he's probably the safest bet. It's weird.
Scrum half 13 points.
The selection back in the good old days used to always be Greg Laidlaw, because he was always kicking the points. That was used to be my philosophy, was you maximise your kickers, but obviously with no Farrell and with no French scrum half kicking, you can't really do that as much. And it has been my downfall with Thomas Ramos. Maybe we'll see something different next time. But yeah, I also hoped that Danny Kerr was going to have a blinder against Scotland. I'd said in private that there was going to be a drop goal. I was right. I also said it was possibly going to be Danny Kerr scoring it, because you know he's got a history of drop goals against Scotland. It was not. He didn't have the best weekend for me.
You put too much faith in your boys, Henry. That's the problem.
Yeah, my special pick, my fantasy pick of the week, Danny Kerr, scored me a grand total of 2 points.
Remarkable. As we said earlier on the podcast, Sam France from last week called out and said, Dan Sheehan.
He did indeed, and that scored him.
Finally got 21 points.
Exactly. I made sure I selected him as well. I wasn't going to make the mistake I did last time. I almost think it's weird this year, because there seems to be a lot of players that, you know, are playing well, but they're not getting the points. Aaron Wainwright scored only 14. Sione Tuipulotu, I know he went off pretty much after half time. He got 4 points. Dan Cole had a really good game from the scrum, and he only scored 6 points. I feel like this year props have been really almost underpowered.
Absolutely.
But Tyke Byrne, 41 points. Yeah, he saved me this week.
Both weeks he started, I've whacked him in and he's been phenomenal, let's just say.
Yeah.
He'll be in my starting lineup next week, I'm afraid.
So onto the news. There's one big talking point this week, and that is Wasps are back, perhaps. It's been announced that they have found funding and a stadium to play at, so long as they can get readmitted into an appropriate league. But the big talking point is, what league do they go into? I personally think first year you stick them in National One. We saw it with London Welsh when they went into administration. They got dropped all the way to the bottom, and there's calls for that, especially I've seen if Wasps don't pay their players their outstanding wages that are owed and pay their staff. But I think National One's probably fair to give them a good shot of being able to rise through. London Welsh were an established Championship side that had a couple of flirtations with the Premiership. All respect to them, but Wasps aren't that. Wasps are Heineken Cup winners. They are not to say that London Welsh aren't a historic club, because they definitely are, but Wasps are in a different level.
Absolutely.
I think, and perhaps there's an argument that even London Welsh should have been put into National 1 or National 2 when they came back, but I think if Wasps can come back with the funding that they claim to have and the stadium that they claim to have, National 1, give them a year, let them get promoted organically into the Championship rather than putting them in the Championship and making them almost just get promoted automatically, almost doing what they did to Saracens when they got relegated, just sort of give them a year in limbo. I think Wasps need time to grow its roots again, to grow that local fan base, particularly if they're talking about moving back to the London area. And also just develop a squad, develop that youth setup and let those players start to come through a little bit.
Come on.
Apologies if the audio sounds a little bit different now. We've just had to leave the More From Grace studios halfway through recording as there was a fire alarm. So, yeah. Anyway, Ricky, what are your thoughts on the idea of Wasps coming back?
Well, I had some excellent thoughts that were rudely interrupted, but from what you were saying, stick them in Nat 1 in a nice organic growth position.
Exactly.
Not to be like jumping on the bandwagon, but I completely agree with you. I've seen some calls to put them in the Prem and to ensure that we don't lose another club and we boost in it with another club. Personally, that is just remarkably insulting to the likes of Ealing Trailfinders and, yeah, Doncaster, all the teams like the sadly gone Jersey Reds now. It's just purely insulting to those clubs that have been effectively ring fenced off, and then a club that goes bust is allowed straight back in. Surely not. Straight into Nat 1. Don't put them at the bottom either. It's just... I don't know what it'll do to the pyramid, but it won't be a good thing.
I think it's also an interesting conundrum if they do go straight into the Prem, of where do they get their players from? Because we've seen it in the PWR that, you know, you have these teams come in, we have Leicester, we have Ealing come in, where they've had to build their own squad, you know, quite quickly in a matter of a season and just come straight in and compete. But it's different in the Premiership, because in the PWR it's now 9 teams. It was 10, unfortunately, with the loss of Worcester Women's. That's changed it, but 10 professional teams is a very different scenario to 10 professional men's teams in England plus across the world and a fully functioning championship. I think if you put Wasps straight back in to the Premiership, you're signing the death note to the championship, quite frankly.
Exactly, I agree. It's just pure insulting. One, two, what does it say about the championship? Again, we don't care.
Yeah, I think exactly that. And if they did go back into Nat 1, maybe they could play their first season in Nat 1, maybe until they get into the championship. Even if they're in the championship at their ground at Wasps FC in Acton and start there. And then if they're saying they've got this agreement to go to a stadium, maybe they could move there, if it's providing it obviously fits 10,000. If they then get promoted into the Premiership, maybe when they get promoted into the Championship as well.
Well, personally for me, to see them in Nat 1, my local club is Rosslyn Park. That would just be a fantastic matchup, wouldn't it, Henry?
Oh, it would.
Can you imagine? I think it's bringing a new light to Nat 1 that, you know, people will lap up a little bit. And more London rivalries, there's a lot more London clubs in Nat 1, aren't there?
Yeah, I think there's also a romance to Nat 1, because we've seen the likes of Cordy, we've seen Cambridge, we've seen Ampthill all come up in the past few years and really thrive in the Championship. And they've shown, you know, Ampthill, I don't know if you've ever been, but they've got a really interesting little ground. I remember that there was all the talk about when Saracens got relegated, that these Premiership players, Owen Farrell, Billy Vanapola, Maro Toje, are going to have to walk from the changing rooms, walk I think it's like 200 metres through a woods to get to this pitch that is just carved into the side of a hill with a really nice view over the Ampthill scenery. But, you know, they're a Championship club now. And yes, you've got Rams based in Reading, you've got Sedgley Park, you've got Sale, not to be confused with Sale Sharks, you've got Blackheath, you've got Richmond, you've got Rosslyn Park, you've got some really historic clubs, and a Wasps side there wouldn't be too out of place, I don't think, particularly if they started off playing in Acton at, was it Twyford Avenue?
Oh, you know what, I know that Ealing and Wasps wouldn't be in the same league initially, but Acton, Ealing, that's that West London rivalry.
Yeah, exactly. There has been some talks. It's been more a proposal from initially Elmer Smith, and we've seen since then our friend Dan Gallen jumping on it. Could they join the URC?
Isn't it, if we're going on in terms of how do you get your squad together, isn't that just utterly pointless?
I agree, but I think joining the URC would be more viable than joining the Premiership straight away, because the URC is already a franchise model. It already runs on that franchise model, whereas the Premiership and the English Pyramid are clubs. So I think they would have access to more funding, because obviously you have no promotion, no relegation. You'd have that benefit for them. Mr. Dan Gallen did actually suggest an alternative, which was two tiers within the URC, almost created as a two-league structure, where you have the top half and then you have the bottom half, and perhaps they could come in that bottom half, although that has been potentially shot down with the idea of South African teams in the bottom half not necessarily being financially viable.
How many teams would be in the top and bottom? Is it just divided in half, or would there be like a new D2?
I imagine it would be just divided in half, maybe. I think it was suggested that maybe you bring in the Cheetahs and then make it an 18-team league. So maybe you have 1 of 10, 1 of 8, for example, or 9 and 9. Or maybe even...
See, nine is an absolute pain in the something, because, as you see with the PWR, every team has a bye week. There's obviously four games every round, and then there's one team having a bye week. From what I... Because I work at Ealing, I don't know if you know.
You've never mentioned it.
There's a 3-week gap between, and you're just like, as a top tier level, you don't want that, do you? You don't want 3 weeks off. You lose your competitive edge. There's only so much training can do.
Yeah, I think there is downsides to that. Another option is potentially starting off as one league and then maybe having like a waterfall thing where you split into two leagues. But again, this is all debate. I think it's not the first time English clubs have been rumoured to be joining the URC. There's been talks about Ealing themselves, allegedly. Whether or not that's true, I couldn't comment. There's been talks in the past about, I think this would have made a lot of sense a few years ago, back when it was the Pro 14, of having London Welsh, London Scottish, and, you know, maybe London Irish, but I don't think they were part of the conversation initially, joining the Pro 14 to make it the Pro 16 before the South African sides joined, having that almost Celtic brotherhood within London. And we know the URC wants to expand into London, that they've got the Ospreys matches at the Stoop.
Yeah.
And there's talks about that. There's been talks about that happening again. So it's a wild idea. It's a little bit rogue, but it could happen.
It's definitely feasible. Henry, it's been a wonderful podcast, isn't it?
It has indeed, even with all the fire alarm troubles.
Our apologies, as always. You know, we try our very best to deliver a seamless production. However, the studios have been compromised today.
Hopefully, that's the only time it happens. Thank you for joining us. We have been Wolf and Grace, and we'll see you again next week.
Take care.